Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FoxBet. 1 week closer to crowning a college football national champion, and not a whole lot more clarity from the College Football Playoff Committee and their Tuesday unveilings. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only, Payne Insider.
Top of the morning to you.
How are you, good sir?
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Payne, I did not see Florida State anywhere in the College Football Playoff Committee's top 25 yesterday. I was a little bit disappointed.
No. We are going bowling, though, so that's something to be happy about. Oh, yeah.
Nothing says holiday celebrations as a proud fan of Florida State or an alum of that upstanding academic institution of heading to Shreveport, Louisiana for the Independence Bowl right around Christmas time. But I digress. That, of course, not the topic at hand.
Hopefully Dion's on the sidelines there. He can can double down as a mascot for another year.
We did see the top four unveiled last night, and no real changes. LSU number one, Ohio State number two, Clemson number three, Georgia number four. And on the outside looking in, Alabama, Oregon, and, of course, Utah. Payne, we know the top three very much control their own destiny. I still believe that Georgia does, not going out on a limb there, saying that if those four teams were to potentially win out, and I know Georgia and LSU can't both win out, but to meet in an SEC championship where Georgia were to beat them, that would be the four in the College Football Playoff. Doesn't add any intrigue. But what say you if one of those teams were to go down? LSU, I think, can withstand a loss. The others, not so much. Who becomes the beneficiary, and what team do you believe is most deserving of getting in of that trio from, well, let's call it a quartet, Alabama, Utah, Oregon, and let's throw Oklahoma in there for argument's sake.
Yeah, if Georgia were to lose, they're certainly out. Clemson were to lose, unfortunately, I just think the schedule just isn't good enough to keep them in the playoff picture. If LSU were to lose in the SEC championship game to Georgia, I think they're still included, obviously. I can't get behind Oregon for whatever reason. It just doesn't look right to me. And I kind of just too close to that coaching staff. But I think they would probably make the most sense. We talked a little bit off air. Utah is an interesting candidate. You would fear, though, that, you know, if they were matched up with a team like LSU, if it was 1-4, how they're going to defend through the air. We've kind of seen that situation play out with USC and their pass catchers just feasting. But it would be an interesting matchup, right? You have Zach Moss potentially grinding it out against an LSU defense that has been pretty susceptible against the run the last 2 weeks. Ole Miss just gashed him last week. Thank God for us. But that's kind of how
Saved
I see
hook,
it play
baby.
Out.
Saved by the hook.
It was a 10-point game late. I just can't believe it required that. But yeah, that's kind of how I see it play out. Oregon, Utah, Alabama, really the only three outsiders with a chance in my estimation, unless, you know, Penn State pulls off a miracle this week.
Oh, that would be a shocker of all shockers. If Penn State goes into Columbus and wins this football game, given their current form, that, of course, will be one of our big games that we'll break down on today's show. Full disclosure here, it was a little bit lean, so we tended to go off the grid for, well, one school that made an appearance last week, three schools that haven't made an appearance all that regularly on the history of the Bet the Board College Football Podcast Edition. But credit to the Indiana Hoosiers. They acquitted themselves quite well last weekend, coming up just short against Penn State, Payne. And by that result, they get back into the mix, playing host to the Michigan Wolverines. We're right now at FoxBet. You're looking at Indiana, a 9-point underdog, total on the game, 52.5. And I guess there's a number of factors that'll play into this particular handicap. Michigan off a very emotional win against Michigan State, knowing what lies in waiting as they'll welcome in Ohio State next weekend to close out their regular season. An Indiana team that threw the ball all over Penn State just wasn't able to get a key stop late in the game. And when you look at recent history between these two teams, Michigan hasn't exactly dominated. No margin of victory greater than 11 points in their last four meetings. And their last two trips to Bloomington, while it hasn't been decided in four quarters, they've required overtime to get through Indiana in each of those meetings. When you look at this matchup, Payne, how do you go about trying to find an edge if you wanted to make a case for the home underdog, knowing that Michigan might be a little bit flat here?
Yeah, I think that's probably the interesting element to this game, right? When you look at, you know, what Indiana wants to do, they're an offensive team, right? First and foremost. And, you know, we kind of, I don't want to say we made the mistake because I was actually intrigued with Indiana last week a little bit. I wanted to get in and out on the first half and just didn't end up making that play. I think it's easy, right, when you look at Indiana's schedule to be like, you know, eh, toughest three teams faced, lost all of them. The seven wins, they're kind of phony. They come against, you know, teams with an average efficiency ranking of 111. To me, when I dig into them, I've been higher than most on the Hoosiers. I think you just throw out the Ohio State game. It's just not fair, right? Like, nobody's looked remotely close to themselves going against the Buckeyes this season. But you look at, like, what Indiana's done offensively the last two games, right, against two top 20 defenses in Northwestern and Penn State, and they've been fantastic, you know? So it's still this team that's led by its offense. You look in those two games, well above the national average in yards per play both games. You go back to the game against Michigan State, and I get that, you know, Penix was the quarterback then. But they go on and complete 20 straight passes. I like what the Indiana offense is doing. It's legit to me. The matchup, though, on paper seems pretty tough, right? Like, this is going to be good on good. Don Brown's defense, you look at what they do well, they defend the pass, they get after the passer. And so it's like cliche, and it's coach speak, right? It's going to come down to, like, the more focused, more prepared team that executes best. But I think that's the case because Indiana wants to pass it, right? Their strength is their quarterback, receivers. Their offensive line is significantly better in pass protection than it is creating space in the run game. And so it's strength on strength. It's going to be important to me, I think, that Stevie Scott does enough, right, on the ground to make Michigan respect run. It's important when Peyton Ramsey sees an opportunity to take off and use his legs that he does, right? Registered a 70% rushing success rate last week on his 10 carries against Penn State. But I think, you know, the bottom line is Indiana's O-line has to be great protecting Ramsey. Ramsey has to continue to be accurate. I think it's important that you hit a couple explosive plays, something they haven't been great at and something Michigan's been fantastic negating, right? So this is just a tough matchup. In my mind, we're looking at all these spots, these situations, and thinking Indiana's better than what I think the national narrative is, and that's true, but the matchup scares me just a little bit. We have to see if Wapfiler passes concussion protocol. He's far and away the Hoosiers' best pass receiver. David Ellis, I think, probably did a really good job last week being the lead man, because Filer went down there in the second quarter with the concussion. But I just, you need all hands on deck here offensively. But when you look at Indiana, just across the board, they're a pass-first team. So they're going to have to find success throwing the ball. That's the big question mark, because that's where Michigan excels. So there isn't really this great matchup advantage through the air, even though that's where they excel.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit easier to move it against Penn State secondary than what they're going to find this week at home against a Michigan team that's really found its swagger. You look at Hudson and Metellus and what they've given Michigan as far as stability in the back. This almost looks and feels like a very different football team, even on the defensive side. And you go back and you look at their schedule and you try and figure out how they were absolutely shredded by Wisconsin in late September. You'd love to see that particular matchup again, as I'm sure Michigan fans would, because I think they would fare significantly more favorably than what they've accomplished there. When you look on the other side of the ball, Michigan's offense clearly got things going. Coach Harbaugh arguably saying that it was Shea Patterson's best game since taking over as the Wolverines' starting quarterback. and you look at what he was able to do, threw for 384 yards. Ronnie Bell was the major recipient, 9 catches, 150. And Michigan finished the game with 467 yards of offense, 7 yards per play, and punted only once on the opening possession of the game. For all the improvements Indiana has shown on the offensive side, we know defense has been the calling card for Tom Allen, but I have to imagine, hey, yet again, Payne, they're going to have their hands full by athletes in space and a resurgent Michigan offense that's been clicking on all cylinders the last couple weeks.
First thing is, I agree with Harbaugh. I thought that was Shea Patterson's best game in a Michigan uniform against the Spartans, right? When you think of the opponent, when you think of how big that matchup is, the in-state rivalry, right? You go out there, you complete 73% of his passes, 58% of Shea's throws graded successfully, doesn't throw a pick. The key thing there, which was a change from what we've seen this season, on passing downs, Shea Patterson was very good, right? And we think of this Sparty defense as being somewhat elite, right? They've been gashed in recent weeks, and they've shown some glitches throughout the season, but they're still top 25. But you look at Shea, he goes 9 for 11, averages 10 yards attempt on known passing situations. And what I keep coming back to, and you've kind of brought it to our attention here, when you talk to a lot of players, coaches, they say when an offense changes its scheme, it takes about 7 or 8 games to start feeling, you know, somewhat comfortable. And we've constantly referenced that second half of the Penn State game numerous times for numerous reasons. But Penn State was game 7 for this Michigan offense. And in that second half, Shea in the passing game started to take off, and it wasn't for, you know, a bell drop in the end zone. You're probably seeing overtime there, and that game could be completely different. For this specific matchup, I think it's all about first down, right? As great as Shea was on known passing downs against Sparty, I think that's still the key here. And if you look at Michigan's offense, they drop off a cliff on second and third down. They're outside the top 80 in success rate on those two downs. And if you look where Indiana's defense excels under Tom Allen, it's third down defense, 13th in the country in third down success rate allowed. Now, I think you can make the case that Indiana's, you know, a little light in the trenches defensively. They can be run on, 78th in line yards, 65th in stuff rate. And if Michigan is able to get the ground game going, Shea Patterson's been at his very best when you can use play action, right? When there is this added play fake element, Shea Patterson is completing 65% of his passes for 9.5 yards an attempt with a 10-to-1 touchdown to interception ratio. So it's important that Indiana's defense, if you're watching this game, just prevents Michigan from being successful on first down, right? Don't allow them to pick up 5 or more yards on first down. If they can do that, then you force Michigan into second and third and long. Play action becomes less effective. And then Indiana probably has a shot defensively. To me, when I went back, because I watched a lot of that game last week, kind of kicking myself for not playing the first half or Indiana in general, I don't even think the score was an indicative of what actually transpired, right? Like, Indiana could have won that game, I think, you know? And you look at Tom Allen's defense, it was fantastic. Held Penn State to 5.5 yards per play. That's well below the national average. Held Penn State to a 38% success rate on offense. And if you look, Indiana was actually positive 12% in net success rate. So Hoosiers obviously need another big effort defensively here. They need to hunker down when Michigan gets into the money zone and gets into the red zone. That's one thing they have struggled a little bit with defensively, because they aren't big in the trenches, and that's where teams usually start to run the ball a little bit more. Indiana's outside the top 50 in green zone and red zone touchdown percentage allowed. So, you know, that has to improve here. But to your point, at the very top, you mentioned a couple things, and I think they're interesting elements here. They're obviously tough to quantify, so they would just kind of be treated as add-ons to the pie, so to speak. But they do both slant in Indiana's favor. And the first one, obviously, is you're catching Michigan here between the in-state rival game against Michigan State, and then they have Ohio State on deck. All the while, you know, you look at the spot for Indiana, it's the last home game of the season. It's senior day for Indiana. It's the final home game. Tom Allen's kind of talked about this senior class, how they've changed the direction of the program. He's going to recognize 16 seniors. And so you sent me this tweet, I believe it was Sunday night. It was Shea Patterson's interview with Brad Gulley of WXYZ Detroit. And Shea Patterson flat out says, we're going to enjoy this win, But in the back of our minds, we know there's one more big one to go. We got to go to on the road to Indiana, but our eyes are still set on the last one, meaning Ohio State. So Harbaugh has to figure out a way to get his guys motivated for the trip to Indiana, it sounds like. And the other thing, which you touched on, is these close meetings. And I know Indiana's lost 23 straight against Michigan, but last season they led at halftime. 2 years ago, Indiana lost in overtime by 7. 3 seasons ago, Indiana led at halftime. And then in Harbaugh's first season in Ann Arbor, Michigan required overtime to beat Indiana again. So the last 4 meetings have been really tight. And everything that Indiana said is, from their coaching staff to the players, this is the best iteration of the Hoosiers over the last 4 years. So that's what makes this really interesting. If it gets to 10 and Wap Filer's in, it's going to be difficult not to at least have a few shekels on the Hoosiers.
Yeah, it should be an interesting game, because when we talk about mental toughness at the college football level, the man under center for the Michigan Wolverines might not be the guy that I would put on my Mount Rushmore. So let's see how Shea handles a little bit of success, knowing what lies in waiting, as Michigan's season will largely be defined by that home game against Ohio State. You just have to wonder for the Wolverines how much different this campaign really could have been if they were able to hang on to that ball in the end zone for Ronnie Bell against Penn State, them coming into this final stretch with just one loss, arguably in control of their own destiny in terms of getting to the college football playoff. A team, though, Payne, that definitely controls its own destiny in the college football playoff would be the Georgia Bulldogs. And they're listed as 13.5-point favorites this weekend at Fox Bet. Total on the game, 45, as they welcome in Texas A&M. And thanks to unbalanced scheduling in the SEC, this will actually be the first time these two teams have met as a member of the same conference. You have to go back to 2009 when they met in the Independence Bowl, a game that I think about 9 people watched, unless you were wagering on. And when you look at Texas A&M this season, we talked about it on the preseason podcast. We knew how daunting this schedule was coming into 2019. The only 3 losses that Jimbo Fisher's team has suffered this season, all the top 10 caliber opponents in Clemson, Alabama, and Auburn. Eventually, you'd love to have that season-defining win. Does A&M have the horses to pull off a big upset and throw a major wrench into the college football playoff?
Were you part of the 11% that tuned into that bowl game?
There's no doubt I was. I feel that there were injuries involved. There was some weird total movement and everything else. There's a 98% probability that if there is a bowl game and it was played somewhere, whether it was in this country or elsewhere, that I was tuned in for at least a drive or two.
You love to watch your games. I like it.
Bowl games, I don't feel I have to watch nearly as much, because you're not going to learn anything about them that you can apply to subsequent weeks unless there's a lot of young players on display. Those games I can ignore from a watchability standpoint a lot more than you could ignore anything during the course of the regular season.
So this past Saturday, how was the anxiety levels not being able to watch every snap?
Oh, they were pretty high. They were pretty high. And, you know, the man and woman
who were... You actually texted me more this past Saturday than the other Saturday.
The man and woman who are married, I know the husband listens to this podcast on a pretty regular basis. He might not be this week, as he honeymoons somewhere off in the Caribbean.
There's nothing like hearing our sweet voices while making babies.
Clay Travis was the officiant and did make a pregnancy joke during the course of the wedding vows that had half of the room laughing hysterically, the other half of the room looking around going, wait, did that really just happen? I think a lot of it has to do with East Tennessee jokes that I'll never quite understand, not being that familiar with that region of country. But there's no doubt about it. I mean, I'm trying to track games throughout the course of the day. Of course, our big position on Iowa for all the loyal podcast listeners. You send me a text, I'm done, I'm out, I don't care. And I'm trying to figure out what the hell happened on the game. Well, keeping in mind, I have a lot of Iowa fans that I'm friends with, having grown up in the Midwest, that text me, wait, no, it's a unsportsmanlike conduct, the ball turned over, then Minnesota gets the ball back. And then on top of that, trying to figure out what the hell's going on with our beloved Oregon State Beavers late in the game against Arizona State. My dad didn't text. He actually called me at the wedding and said, Herm's going for 2. He's going for 2. And, you know, those are the things you have to go through when you don't have multiple TVs at your disposal and you're able to bop around throughout the course of a Saturday.
Yeah, we're going way far left here. I actually snuck out Saturday night. And so I left when Oregon State was up 14. I'm like, we're good here. And I'm in Ford versus Ferrari. Excellent movie, by the way. You should actually go check that out ASAP. And then I saw that we gave up the lead. And I'm texting, man, that was almost a name drop. I texted one of our guys And I'm like, Herm's definitely going for two here. No. And I'm just like updating my phone. It's just not updating. Like bad service or something. I'm like refreshing. It took 12 minutes to figure out that Herm Edwards did go for two and missed it. So I was very, very excited about that. But yes, part of the I'm done here was just so you could be a normal human and get back to your wedding. And then I could watch the game in peace.
I mean, I was sitting at the table during speeches, so of course I was following. Now, I will say a lot of people at the wedding, not just the guys that I was around, trying to figure out how to stream the end of the Baylor-Oklahoma game. That one, I will be completely honest, is everybody was kind of glued to their phones, knowing that it was a pretty fervent college football fan base in attendance.
Interesting. I didn't watch that finale, but Baylor choked that puppy away. All right, let's get back to the task at hand here so we can get out of here at a decent time.
Well, the good thing is we have two games that we can spend about 4 minutes apiece on
later
on in the show.
Yes, those were going to be quick hitters anyways. So A&M Georgia. Let's start with A&M's offense. And, you know, it's why reading is very important. It's why listening to coaches and pressers are very important. And then comparing them to what's actually going on, right? And I've kind of always made this statement, right? There's this idea that everything public is supposed to be factored into every market, right? But I can tell you that's not the case, or groups wouldn't spend six-figure sums on readers. But you can always kind of obtain some information and some mindsets doing some reading. And you listen to A&M this week, Todd, right? It's all about, hey, our offense is finally clicking. It's been the most efficient it's been all season the last three games, and you know that they're rounding into form and they're going to close out the season with double digit wins. I don't see that from their offense, right? When you look at the Aggies, like over their last three data points, it's certainly an offensive unit that has shown some signs, but you're looking at how they're doing it and it's on the ground, right? They've ran the ball 62% of the time the last three games, and it's smart. Right, I'm not saying it's not very smart, because you look at the three defenses they've played, combined average rank 71st in rushing success rate allowed. And I know when you look at this matchup, we've kind of mentioned for years now, or at least the last two, that Georgia's underlying trench metrics, they're not as good as people think. I'm just not sure that A&M's going to be able to go out there and punch Georgia in the mouth, though. And I don't see A&M's O-line as being some like dominant force. There's a lot of turnover with that unit coming into the season. I just don't know if they're going to consistently win in the trenches and allow Spiller to kind of run wild here. I do think there needs to be some semblance of balance, right? I think Mon needs to use his legs. There needs to be 12, 18 designed runs here where he creates this added man advantage in the box. And then when it is time to throw, Mon needs to be a difference maker. He needs to be accurate, right? And I think if you're an A&M fan here or a backer, and there's certainly some money on that side, you're hoping for the excellent Kellen Mond, right? Because I think when you look at his peak, he's probably a day two draft pick, right? He can be a guy that carries a college offense. Unfortunately, you look at him and he's just like wildly inconsistent. He's been above average, I would say, as a quarterback throughout the season. If you can get the version of Kellen Mond from the second half of the Auburn game, A&M has a shot to win this thing outright. That was far and away his best performance of the season, aside from the opener against Texas State. But if you look at the five games this season where Kellen Mond has played a top 50 defense, which is obviously what he's going to face here with Georgia, and he's only completing 59% of his passes in those games. You know, Clemson goes out, holds them to a 36% passing success rate. Alabama, who, you know, was gashed against an elite offense, the only one it's faced all season, held Kellen Mond to a 37% passing success rate. I know we've kind of clamored and banged the table for Isaiah Spiller to get the ball more, and he's certainly got to be a factor, but this comes down to me, to Kellen Mond being a willing runner and an accurate passer. If he does that, I think A&M stays within the number. If he doesn't, I think Georgia's ground game likely takes over, you know?
Well, you mentioned Georgia's ground game, and I think that becomes the interesting matchup on the other side. Georgia didn't exactly light the world on fire with their offensive performance against Auburn. If anything else, it was build a lead, hold on for dear life, and hope that 15 drives totaling 64 plays and 251 total yards with four scoring opportunities is enough to win a game on the road in conference. Now, I know it's different when you come back home, but clearly Jake Fromm and his 13 of 28 performance with a QBR of 21, a little bit of a different dynamic if you're asking him to win by two touchdowns plus against a capable A&M side. How do you see this Georgia offense matching up with A&M defensively? And I guess the $100 million question, anytime you want to bet against Georgia or even make a case, you know, for a total one way or another, can the Aggies hold up in the trenches and slow down DeAndre Swift, making Georgia a little bit more one-dimensional than even Kirby Smart and company would like?
Yeah, I mean, those are probably all the key factors here. And to your point, last week, it's like 21-0. I kind of forget about the game. I look up after I get a text. It's like Auburn's driving to tie it. I'm like, what? And the Bulldogs offense was really only good on three possessions. It's hard to imagine in 2019 you go out on the road and you win a game where your offense gains 3.9 yards per play and is successful on 30% of your offensive snaps. But that's kind of what Georgia's offense did last week. It was an absolute grinder. And I guess credit to Georgia, right, for withstanding that kind of, you know, physical game, knowing Auburn was rested off a bye. So you got to give them a little bit of credit, you know, in that regard. I think the blueprint's out there, though. Right? It's just extremely difficult to execute it because Georgia's O-line is elite. Top 10 in both line yards and sack rate allowed. So they're pretty well-versed whether they want to run or pass. But the blueprint's there, right? It's see if you can stop DeAndre Swift running. And it's tough to do because he's electric. It's an elite O-line. But if you can force Fromm and the receivers into these known passing down situations, the dogs struggle a little bit. You look, they're 33rd in the country in third down success rate. It's been an issue, I think, pretty much all season. It showed up in the past, right, against Auburn. Fromm had 8 total passing yards on 10 known passing downs. It was the reason they couldn't complete the comeback against South Carolina. They struggled in those known passing situations. I think what we have to find out, though, is can A&M consistently, you know, stop the ground game to force Fromm and the Georgia offense into these, you know, into these situations that aren't so easy for them. And I think, you know, after I was doing some digging, I'm kind of leery, right? I know A&M did a really good job stopping South Carolina's ground game last week, but you just kind of look, A&M's 87th in the country in yards per carry allowed after you back out the sack yardage. They're 81st in explosive run defense. They do get beat up a little bit in the trenches, 53rd in line yards allowed. It's kind of translated to a 56% rushing success rate allowed by opponents. So I just, A&M has to sell out to stop the run here. And to me, and Todd, you watch more of these games, they tend to be a little feast or famine defense. Like, sure, they create some havoc. They do a good job stuffing runs, but that aggressiveness is kind of why they've allowed so many big runs. What I can say is this. At more than two touchdowns, A&M came from a very respected group. It was only a numbers grab because the limits were super low. But I think the idea of it is basically a combination of Georgia not being overly explosive through the air, so it's kind of tough to pull away, right? They're coming off a physical game like Auburn. They have LSU on deck. Jimbo Fisher plays at a snail's pace. And if you've listened to this podcast for a long time, it was one thing I would really beat him up about at Florida State, right? When you have more talent, you want to play at a quicker pace. And we know, right, Georgia's okay playing at a really slower pace. So the snaps are going to be limited here. And I can tell you firsthand, when Georgia's coaching staff looked at this schedule in the offseason, this was the game that scared him. Right, this was the game they kept referencing, like, hey, this could be a tricky one. It made them a little nervous. So, you know, to your point, Texas A&M shown to be pretty capable. The three losses are against three elite teams, and Georgia isn't this overly explosive offense. So, you know, the side here is certainly A&M, Todd.
Interesting game, one that I'd love to see A&M be able to push Georgia late into the fourth quarter, so we have a little intrigue and potentially throwing chaos into the college football playoff. Because, Payne, all of our Bet the Board listeners only need Georgia to show up the first Saturday in December for us to cash our 3-1 ticket on Georgia to win the SEC. It's not about the national championship. or the college football playoff.
I can't wait till you have everyone hedge out of that thing.
We're not hedging out of it yet. All right, we're going to wait. We're going to see what the numbers look like. We're going to assess the situation like we do once we have all the variables to factor into the equation. And then we will make the most prudent financial decision we could possibly make, not only with our money, but the money of our loyal listeners as well. Better?
Continue.
All right. We're going to go to the American Athletic Conference because I know Group of Five football is always your favorite.
Back-to-back weeks, baby, Navy.
They like to call themselves the Power Six Conference. I think that's a little bit presumptuous, if you don't mind my saying so. Navy, they welcome in the SMU Mustangs, and it's Navy, a 3.5-point favorite. Total in this game, 67.5. The loser of this game will be eliminated from conference championship contention. You have to go all the way back to 1998 to find the last time SMU last defeated the Naval Academy. I think I was 16 years old back then. May have just received my driver's license. High-level look is simple, Payne. The Middies lead the country in rushing, 349 yards per game by way of their triple option, while SMU ranks 30 in rush defense overall. Navy last weekend done in by turnovers before the game really even got out of neutral, four fumbles, and the Irish took full advantage. SMU a chance to save their season, so to speak. But I have to imagine, if you're Sonny Dykes and you're Shane Buechele, you're looking at the way this Navy secondary was exploited. You have to be licking your chops and think big play potential will present itself early and often in Annapolis on Saturday.
Absolutely. But I do like Xavier Jones. I love the way he runs. I guess maybe it's just the number and his style. He reminds me of Reggie Bush. It's like Reggie Bush light. So, you know, it's important. I think he gets going. The one thing Navy does well defensively, and they have all season, it stopped the run. 10th in line yards. They've allowed 34% of runs to great successful. It's 15th best in the country. And if you look at yards per carry allowed when you remove sack yardage, Navy's 14th. They only allow about 4 yards per rush. Even last week, right? Like, I know Notre Dame dominated, but their top three rushers, Jones Jr., Armstrong, and Ian Book, had 69 total yards on 21 carries. So if Xavier Jones isn't rolling on the ground for SMU, I think it's important. Get him catching balls out of the backfield, something I think we should probably see more of. When I look at him, he seems pretty dynamic. 18 receptions isn't enough. But to your point at the top, and we'll make this pretty quick, Shane Buechele has to pick up chunks through the air. And I know he's been dynamite this season. If you look, and SMU is going to be down a little bit in the receiver core, right? I think their number two receiver, Reggie Roberson, is out.
Yep,
so,
officially ruled out for this game again.
Yeah, he's their number two guy. So that certainly hurts a little bit because you want, you know, all hands on deck. You want your strength to really show itself against a weakness. But if you look at Shane Buechele, 22nd in explosive passing. He actually leads the nation in deep passing yards. And I think what makes that so impressive is only 19% of his pass attempts are deep. So when SMU does take shots, it's really efficient doing so, right? It's not these like freaking just like chuck and duck, close your eyes and throw deep kind of thing. And we saw throughout, I think, the course of time, and even last week against Notre Dame, it was one of the focal points for us. Navy struggles defending the pass on the perimeter. You know, obviously they don't recruit like world-class athletes out there, but they don't practice against passing offenses. So that's where these opponents find their edge. SMU obviously has to take advantage of Navy's defense through the air here, because to me, let's see what Xavier Jones does, right? If he's able to run the ball, then the Mustangs have a good chance here. But if it is one-dimensional, it's on Shane Buechele to kind of hit Navy where they're most susceptible, and that's through the air. So that's what this game comes down to. Can Buechele and that passing offense really create some dynamic plays, really create some explosiveness? And if they do, they'll have a shot here. It's always like this catch-22, though, Todd. Do you want to, like, score extremely quickly against Navy and put your defense back out there? That's always the tough debate.
Well, I think, you know, Notre Dame did it well last week. Yes, they were the beneficiary of countless Navy turnovers early. I think if you can score multiple times quickly and build a multi-possession lead against Navy, then it puts you in the catbird seat. But if you're going to try and trade them score for score and you're going down the field in four plays, 75 yards in a minute and 26 seconds, and Navy comes right back out there and they put together a 7 to 8 minute march, ultimately it's going to wear down and your margin for error for that pass-happy offense tends to erode as you go through four quarters.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other $100 million question when you look on the other side of the ball. Notre Dame did a good job early on. And Malcolm Perry took full responsibility for the turnovers. I don't think it was just Notre Dame stopping them. It was Navy stopping themselves. You have to imagine they're going to be better with the ball here. Can SMU, despite those rushing numbers, or excuse me, the rushing numbers defensively are relatively strong, can they stop a Navy team that over the last couple of years, let's not kid ourselves, has had a tremendous amount of success moving the football against this SMU defensive front?
Yeah, and again, it'll sound pretty basic, but it's really the only thing that matters, right? Can Navy run the football? If they can, they got a great shot to win. If they can't, they won't. It's really that simple. There isn't this second option for Navy's offense. Obviously, their first option is very good. But when you look at SMU's defense, their D-line has done a good job for the most part, right? They haven't been bullied in the trenches. They're 26th in line yards. They do a decent job stuffing runs at or behind the line of scrimmage, 50th in that regard. When you kind of parse out just their run metrics, SMU's allowed 36% of runs to grade successful. That's 23rd in the country. However, SMU has a tendency to have some issues, and I'm going to put this nicely, with their assignments at times, right? They give up some really big chunk plays. And Sonny Dykes has kind of talked about that all week, about being disciplined in your assignment. And to his point, SMU's 94th in explosive play defense, 68th in explosive run defense. So they've been really good stopping these runs. They just occasionally get out of their gap. And I think Navy's the kind of offense that will make you pay if you're, you know, you don't have gap integrity. But SMU's defense, to your point, far and away better against the run than pass. You just have to make sure when Navy does throw it a handful of times, and they will, that you're disciplined enough to stop it. The two positive here for SMU, right, and their defense is they've had 2 weeks to prepare, right? The bye came at the right time, not just having extra time to prepare for this quirky offense, but guys got healthy. Like Delano Robinson, he's like the heart of SMU's defense. He's back. And Sonny Dykes has mentioned about how different the unit looks with him in the game, that they communicate better, that they're more sound. So that's a huge get back. So I think the 2 weeks to prepare here is certainly an interesting element.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Navy will not run for 600 yards on the ground like they did against SMU back in 2016. So there's your bold prediction for the week. If anybody's scoring at home, should be a fascinating game. When you look at the number, Payne, we saw some shops open as low as 2.5. Number get out to 4, a little bit of buyback on SMU. A small appetite, it appears, on the under the total. Have you seen anything on this game, side or total?
Yeah, so, you know, Navy did get laid at 3. But to your point, at 4, there was a different viewpoint. So there is a little battle going on here. It'll be interesting to see as we track this. Which group has final say? I think if all things were equal and SMU didn't have 2 weeks to prepare, you'd feel probably a little more confident with Navy's offense. But they did get healthier on the defensive side of the ball. The bye came at the perfect time. So that's all I've seen to this point. By the way, you didn't help yourself with my hedge question when you went out on a limb saying under 600 yards.
Well, I mean, I just wanted to try and redeem myself one way or another. So
very
I feel
conservative
like, I mean,
in both.
I mean, I may as well take what would be a massive favorite in this game for
yes.
Navy not to run
yes.
for 600 yards
yes.
there.
And that being offered anywhere?
No, I have not seen that prop available. I don't imagine a lot of shops, even in this rapidly expanding legalized jurisdiction, that are going to offer props on AAC games, even one that carries such a high profile as the Naval Academy. Taking on SMU on Saturday. And you know what, Payne? A lot of people say that we don't do ACC football, and they're generally right because there hasn't been a whole lot to talk about in the ACC. Sorry, Clemson fans, you guys won't get on this podcast until you get into the college football playoff. That does include an ACC championship where you'll be massive favorites as well. But there is a game that'll have some impact in the Coastal Division this weekend, and it's a resurgent Virginia Tech team playing host to Pittsburgh. You're looking at Virginia Tech, a 4-point favorite at Fox Bet, total in this game now down to 46.5, and it's amazing the difference a change a quarterback can make. It will be Bud Foster's final home game as defensive coordinator of the Hokies. A little 30-point revenge from last year's beatdown for Virginia Tech, but this isn't about revenge. It's not about coaching. It's all about Hendon Hooker.
He's been good. And listen, it's partly Hendon Hooker. It's partly Justin Fuentes getting guys to buy back in, right? And I think it was a Friday night game, the same night we had the Maryland debacle against Penn State. But Justin,
that was a fun watch.
Yeah, Justin Fuentes lost to Duke 45-10 at home on national TV. And at that point, he had like this mea culpa moment in front of the players right after the game, and he put all the blame on himself. And everyone kind of acknowledges that this part in the season for Virginia Tech is labeled AD after Duke. And I think we've seen a drastically different team since then. Everyone's kind of bought back in. There was this tension between players and Justin Fuente and what was transpiring there within the program. None of the guys really seemed to like him. The message wasn't being delivered. That seems to have changed. Hendon Hooker, though, to your point, has been a nice added weapon to this offense. Now, he sat out the Notre Dame game, partly injured, partly because they wanted him to be 100% through, you know, the rest of the season. I think he probably could have played. But he's added a couple different elements, right? This element with his legs has been fantastic, but he's also been a very good passer. 61% completions. He led the comeback at Miami. When you look at what he's doing under pressure, and this is a game that he's going to face some, when you look at Pittsburgh, who's number one in havoc rate, he's been fantastic under pressure. Three touchdowns, no picks in that regard. But this is certainly a tough matchup. Pittsburgh's defense is the calling card of this team. They've done fantastic. They've only allowed 32% of snaps to great successful. It's seventh best in the country. And there is some weather brewing. And that is why you are seeing this total partly get hit under here, because about a 78% chance of rain. So even with Hendon Hooker in and the improvement that we have seen from this Virginia Tech offense, this is a tough test against Pittsburgh's defense. And yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. Anyone can
No,
jump.
Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. Finish your thought, and I'll tack it on to the end.
We'll let you roll.
No, what I was going to say is I think not only has the change to Hooker given them that element, but you're seeing a young offensive line kind of come of age, composed of three true freshmen and two sophomores that we knew were going to go through growing pains. We knew how young this roster was, even on the linebacking core. I think we had talked about it and trying to figure out what Virginia Tech was going to be. But you're seeing them buy in, and with them running quarterback, it's able to mask some of those other issues that you didn't have that luxury with a pocket-style passer, or more of a pocket-style passer in Ryan Willis at the start of the season.
Yeah, I think without question he provides, you know, that added element. And as we look at college football right across the board, a lot of these coaches are going to dual threat quarterbacks. It just, you know, makes it very difficult to contain an offense. And to your point, when you look at Virginia Tech's offensive line with those young guys, they haven't been the best, right? Creating space in the run game, 108th in the country in line yards. So when you can use Hendon Hooker's legs, God, that sounds odd. When you can use his legs, he becomes that added advantage in the box, right? It gives you, you know, one extra player that you have to account for when he's out there running, and it really has helped the offensive line. The other key here is obviously if you can use his legs and you can be successful on early downs, it's going to help your offensive line out in protection as well. So we have seen the Vatek offense make some strides with him under center and with everyone buying back in.
What do you make of Pittsburgh on the defensive side? We know that's kind of been their calling card for this group, an offense that we'll get to in a second that struggled for stretches. The defense has been the one stalwart. They can get after the quarterback. They're disruptive. They have a good defensive line, and that's obviously how Pat Narduzzi made his money as a defensive coordinator at other stops. Can this Pitt defensive line create some problems for this Virginia Tech team and ultimately give their offense some short fields? Sam Howell had success throwing vertically, but it felt like a lot of that came in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, you know, kind of what we talked about already at this point. That's why it's so vital that Hendon Hooker is able to use his legs and create these opportunities on early downs, because that is the strength, is Pittsburgh's defense. They're number one in the country in havoc rate. They get after the quarterback. So that's going to be the strength here for them. If they can prevent Virginia Tech's offense from being successful in early downs, then you can kind of attack that weakness of Virginia Tech's offense, which is that O-line. So that'll be the thing to watch here. Can Hendon Hooker and this Vatek offense be successful in early downs? If they can't, Pittsburgh and Narduzzi is going to send some heat. That'll be the one advantage here, because you can only mask and disguise offensive line deficiencies for so long. And when you're pressed in weird situations, that's usually when your weakness is shown.
Other side of the ball, Pittsburgh offensively, we know they want to chuck it and duck it with Kenny Pickett and Mark Whipple. That was going to be their mentality coming into the season. It's not an offense that's been overly efficient by any stretch of the imagination. Pickett did throw for 359 yards, though, in their win against North Carolina, going 25 of 41. Utilized his legs a little bit, and I think what's been interesting, he's completed passes of at least 25 yards to five different receivers, so it's shown that he's willing to spread it around and pick up a big play here or there. But who, in your opinion, has an advantage when you look at Bud Foster's last home game as defensive coordinator leading that Virginia Tech defense against the Pittsburgh offense that can probably best be described as erratic?
Yeah, to your point, you know, this relationship with Mark Whipple and, you know, his pass-happy offense and his tempo, it always felt like just a really odd fit when you're joining this program that's run first and they're led by, you know, a defensive-minded coach. And I guess, regardless of what the metrics look like, you know, 7-3 isn't bad. Probably should have beaten Miami. You hung tough at Penn State, and your defensive-minded coach chose to kick a field goal from the one down 7 with 4 minutes to go. So, you know, they've been in every game except the opener against Virginia, really. But you're spot on, right? The Pittsburgh offense doesn't look overly efficient. They're not overly efficient. Only 38% of their snaps have graded successful. There isn't an ability to run the ball at all. They're 110th in the country in yards per rush. There is zero explosiveness to the offense, 119th in that category. Bottom line, I think it's like, thank God for Kenny Pickett. He's been fantastic to me, right? Aside from the Miami game, he's a little shaky there, had some early turnovers. But you look at Pittsburgh's offense as a whole, they're 89th in first down success rate. They're 113th in second down success rate. So what does that mean, right? It means that the QBs faced bailing the offense out constantly on third and long situations. And I think that's what Kenny Pickett's done for the majority of this season, because Pittsburgh's actually 44th in third down success rate. So, you know, Pickett's really been up against it this season. Even his receiving core has dropped 24 passes this year, Todd. So I think he's been really good in certain instances. His back's been against the wall. He hasn't been in positive situations. I also like his ability to run the ball a little bit, right? When the play breaks down in the pocket, he's shown a willingness and an ability to use his legs. He's got 250 rushing yards. All but 9 of them have come from unscripted runs. So, to me, though, very tough matchup. You kind of alluded to this. Bud Foster's defense, not only have they gotten back in form, right, but they've been good in general on the season. Their recent success and how they've trended over, I would say, the last two-thirds of the season's been fantastic. It's why they're 19th in success rate allowed, both top 25 in running and passing success rate defense. But Bud Foster is retiring. This is his last home game. He's like, you know, an institutional fixture here, right? I think guys on the defensive side have not only bought in after the Duke game, but they love Bud Foster. They want to send this guy out on a high note. So when you look at that matchup on that side of the ball, it's another reason why this game's getting hit under, in addition to the weather. So I'm just not sure what Pittsburgh's able to do offensively here.
Should be a good game, not one that may be aesthetically pleasing to the casual college football fan, but one that'll have ramifications throughout the ACC and ultimately impact who potentially gets to take on the Clemson Tigers for the right to be their 13th defeat of the season. 13th victory of the season. From the ACC, though, Payne, we have a big game in the Big Ten. You wouldn't know it by the number that's currently being offered throughout the market. Ohio State puts their unblemished record on the line with Penn State coming to town. Line on this game, Ohio State, 18.5-point favorite at Fox Bet. Total on this one, 57. And when you look at the superlatives, the hyperbole that we can heap upon the Scarlet and Gray this season, Ohio State's on pace to become the first team since Virginia Tech in 1999 to lead the nation in scoring offense and scoring defense in the same regular season. They are now the only team in the last 45 years to win each of its first 10 games of a season by 24-plus points. elite by college football historical standards, at least as far as some of the metrics that are out there. If you're Penn State, I ask you this. It hasn't exactly been great when you've gone into Columbus catching two touchdowns plus. You lost 38-10 a couple of years ago, and you lost 63-14 back in 2015, I believe. What can Penn State do to slow down this juggernaut, and do they have the horses to keep this game competitive?
It's a good question. This is actually, I'm off the top of my head here, the fifth straight Penn State game we've broken down. So,
they're making us pay for us backing Maryland against them on that fateful Friday night. We have to continually remind ourselves of the mistakes we make in this business and how we'll go about atoning for them.
Yeah, so I think, you know, a lot of people know our feelings about Penn State's defense to this point. There's a lot of, you know, key factors that we can kind of rehash. But you just look, overall, Penn State continues. They haven't played like this great schedule of opposing offenses. And I think we talked about this a little bit last week. On average, the offensive efficiency ranking of their opponent, 67th. It was actually even worse, 81st, prior to facing two top 15 offenses back-to-back weeks in Minnesota and Indiana. Prior to these last two games, Penn State hadn't faced one top 35 offense all season. And so, you know, thanks to kind of your keen eye watching every snap of every game on a Saturday, you said, you know, that Michigan offense was able to pass all over Penn State's secondary in the second half. So I immediately dug into some things because you raised some good points. So you dig into their metrics. Who have they faced? And how good have the offense has been? And how good has the passing offense been? And you immediately just kind of see that Penn State hadn't played a soul. And then all of a sudden, the last two games against these two top 15 offenses, Penn State's secondary has been exposed, and that is putting it as nice as humanly possible. You look at Tanner Morgan, 2 weeks ago, goes out, completes 90% of his passes. Penn State allows 7.7 yards per play. National average, 5.7. Last week, against a very one-dimensional Indiana offense, without its best receiver for 2.5-plus quarters, averages 6.4 yards per play, has a 50% success rate on your home field, right? Peyton Ramsey was 31 for 41 in known passing situations, 11 for 15 for 214 yards. So you would think, listen, Ohio State's going to do some damage here. Justin Fields has completely shed the label of being a dual threat quarterback, because typically that label means better runner than passer, and obviously he can run, but he is a legitimate passer. And if you look, it's not just the dink and dunk stuff. He's completed over 61% of his downfield throws. 24 touchdowns, one interception on throws 10 or more yards downfield. Has the highest passer rating of any quarterback in college football on throws at least 10 yards. So he's doing something that I think many thought he couldn't. And I think that's why Ohio State's offense has been nearly impossible to stop. And I don't think that's going to change here. I think that they're going to have success moving the ball through the air. I think the key is obviously Penn State's offense starting quickly, because we have seen, at least in some of the bigger games, that Ohio State's offense takes some time to get going a little bit, Todd.
Yeah, they better not have that happen here. I'm not going to say that Penn State will be able to move the ball against Ohio State by any stretch, but you want to go out there and a team coming into your building hell-bent on spoiling your season, you want to put that idea of an upset out of the equation pretty quickly. And you mentioned Penn State and their struggles. I mean, you look at how they performed. Allowed 47 points through their first five conference games. They've given up 58 in their last two. And what I found interesting, Payne, when you poke around and you try and figure out the root cause of why the defense has struggled against the pass, when James Franklin and the coaching staff say that there were two things that they've identified: lack of communication in the secondary, not good on the road in a hostile territory, and tackling an issue, particularly on the perimeter against teams that have found quick passes to gifted receivers to counteract the Penn State pass rush. What does Ohio State do as well as any team in the country? They get the ball to their playmakers in space, one-on-one on the outside. They make you miss, and whoosh, down the field, 50, 60
what
yards
was that?
Later, they find
it. There you go.
I tried it. I don't know if that's better. I'm going to have to keep working on it. So Penn State, for me, this season defensively, if I look for historical parallel, and it's not something that I think is truly apples to apples. Reminds me a lot of Texas A&M the last couple of years. They're very good against the run, but if you have time to throw, forget about it, because if they're not getting to your quarterback, that secondary can't cover at all. And I don't think it gets any easier for Penn State on the other side of the ball, where Sean Clifford has really struggled to find consistency. He was able to extend drives last week against Indiana with his legs. But for all the praise that Ohio State gets on the offensive side, Chase Young missed the last two games. Ohio State, we don't really care about how their defense has performed. This defense is truly a top-tier stop unit, and I'm not sure where Penn State can consistently move the ball against the Buckeyes' defense.
Listen, Ohio State's defense has been dominant, and that's obvious, right? There is not an advantage metrically anywhere for Penn State's offense. And just to kind of put this in perspective, and it's basic, but it's just still staggering. Only 29% of snaps against Ohio State's defense have graded successful. Think about that. Out of every 100 snaps the Buckeyes defense has faced, on average, 29 of them are assessed a positive grade. That's just wild to me. So for Penn State, if they're truly trying to win this game and not just keep it close, and there is a difference, I think Penn State's smart to employ some tempo. See if you can tire out Chase Young and that Ohio State defensive line on longer drives where it has an impact later in the game, right? It's important for Penn State to be better on first downs. Right now, 43rd in the country in first down success rate. So whether it's Journey Brown or Noah Kane, who I believe is going to be back, dressed the last few weeks, didn't actually play, but I think he'll give it a go here. Or even Clifford with his legs, they have to win on first down. Passing on early downs obviously is going to help as well, but I think it's just wildly important because if you can't win first down, you know, Penn State hasn't shown an ability to protect its quarterback in these known passing situations. There's this massive dichotomy. Penn State's O-line has allowed an 11% sack rate on passing downs. That's 105th in the country. On standard downs where there's a run threat, Penn State's O-line, just a 2% sack rate, which is top 10 in the country allowed. So it's obvious you can't have these situations where, you know, Chase Young and company is like attacking your quarterback without a threat of run in mind. It's not going to be pretty. So go tempo to me. Get Sean Clifford using his legs on designed runs. Attack the middle of the defense where Sean Clifford has been at his very best. If you look this season, Todd, 50% of his passing yards have come between the hashes, right? I think there's also a need to take some shots downfield, right? Stretch the defense. Make the Buckeyes defend the entire field. Obviously, like, not every deep shot's going to be completed, but you have to let Ohio State know that they can't cheat. And I think regardless of what transpired in the Minnesota game with Clifford turning it over a little bit, he's been really good this season, you know, through the air. If you look at his average depth of targets, 11.5 yards, so he's not dinking and dunking. And despite that, he's only thrown 6 interceptions. So, you know, the big question for me here is, like, when you see a game like this, two top 10 teams, you would hope the goal is to win. Unfortunately, the line's 18.5, and it's telling you all you need to know. And James Franklin has already, like, eclipsed his season expectations. My hope is that we don't have a defensive-minded coach playing not to get blown out. And obviously, if you go tempo, it could potentially make this game uglier if you aren't efficient using it. So you would just hope the goal here is for James Franklin not to just keep it within a number so people don't start wondering how far his program is from Ohio State. But I think the best way to win is tempo, getting out to a lead, and kind of as I alluded to earlier, we have seen, as great as Ohio State is, sometimes that opening quarter, they're a little groggy, right? So Penn State has to attack early, try to build the lead up here. And I think you do that with some early tempo.
Curious to see, too. I know he didn't finish the game last week, but all indications are that he'll be a go. You're going to want to keep tabs on the status of KJ Hamler. If he is unavailable or somehow limited in this contest, takes away one of the only truly elite athletes that Penn State boasts on their offense, especially in the receiving core. So I'm curious to see what continues to emerge regarding his role in the Penn State vertical passing game, because against the secondary as athletic as Ohio State, it definitely becomes all hands on deck. And as much as you can like Freiermuth, the tight end, that's not the kind of weapon that's going to instill fear into the Scarlet and Gray's defense.
I would think he plays KJ Hamler. Now, he's got to go through all the concussion tests, but if you look, I know they yanked his helmet away from him despite wanting to go back into the game last week, but he was out there, he was active, he was in the tunnel after the game, like giving a little speech. He seems like he is going to play this week.
You would think for a game of this magnitude, as Penn State looks to try and do the unthinkable and knock off Ohio State, that he will be out there. Just something to keep tabs on should that status change, but we know how those things tend to work. Five big games, all broken down as eloquently and as in-depth as we possibly can here on the Bet the Board podcast. Of course, you can follow Payne on Twitter, at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. And of course, follow the podcast, more importantly than either of us, at Bet the Board Pod is where you want to go for that. One final order of business, and Payne, that of course would be our best bet as we put our modest win streak on the line this week. And that bet comes to you courtesy of Fox Bet, where the biggest name in sports is now the hottest name in sports betting and one of the fastest growing betting apps out there throughout New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Whatever sports you like betting on, Fox Bet has you covered. You can download the app to your smartphone from absolutely anywhere and keep tabs on all of the point spread moves while you're on the go. Of course, real money wagering only available in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Fox Bet, make the call, download the app today, and check out all of those generous offers for first-time users. Payne, where are we going to take our hard-earned Iowa cash and put it on the line this weekend?
All the pressure is on. Looking for number four in a row. Your quote there from Major League Two has come to fruition.
Get Lou Brown into the equation, baby. Get Lou Brown here. It's now a winning streak.
So, don't love the board this week, but I do like this one. They've let us down in previous seasons, but they're going to redeem themselves nicely this weekend. Let's go with 167, California plus the three in the big game. Let's just kind of make a note on this. We're taking plus three. We are fine under the assumption that it is Monster starting, although there is a chance that Chase Garbers does potentially play. So, California plus three in the big game. I know you like this one.
I've been a Golden Bears guy this season. I went to the window with them last week, took seven early on against USC. It was a close game for the better part of, let's call it,
we'll let you
quarters.
Get away with that humble brag, by the way.
Well, it didn't matter. It didn't win. Okay. So I'm not one guy that's going to sit here and brag about closing line value when they get their teeth kicked in the second half. So I'm not going to be that guy. Did unravel a little bit, but I think a lot of that was due to USC's athletes and just a Cal team that's not built to play from behind. But you look at Stanford in recent weeks, and I know Davis Mills threw for 500-plus yards in their loss against Washington State. But the Stanford offense right now is extremely one-dimensional. And against the defense led by Justin Wilcox and knowing what his team wants to do, if Stanford can't run the ball, I think that plays right into Cal's hands. They're going to find it much easier to contend with Stanford's wide receiving core than what they did over the last couple weeks. And I think they can do enough offensively in an ugly football game to get to bowl eligibility so they won't have to pin it all on the hopes and dreams against UCLA in the finale. So that's kind of my, you know, two-minute handicap synopsis diatribe. It just looks like Stanford's a team right now, in my opinion, playing out the stretch more so than Cal, who's shown some fight. They just don't have the athletes when they step up.
There we go. Let's get bowl eligible in the big game. Cal plus the three.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
California Golden Bears, our best bet here on the Bet the Board podcast, and as always, brought to you courtesy of Fox Bet, the biggest name in sports, now the biggest name in sports betting. Payne, any other words of wisdom, life advice, final things you'd like to share with our audience before we reconvene about 24 hours from now?
No.
To talk about the National Football
No,
League.
No, that's it. Back tomorrow with the NFL.
All right. We're getting out of Dodge. And come Saturday afternoon, late afternoon, early evening, depending on what time zone you're making this wager, in Palo Alto with a Cal ticket in hand, we'll see you at the window. We'll